Okay. So, as Shenzhen was saying, Buddhism gets a bad rap. It's not all about suffering. Yet, the Buddha and the most ancient teachings did hone in on using practice and our direct experience to notice when suffering arises and what its causes are, which the first and second noble truth, in order to diagnose the problem, bring about the end of suffering, and talk about how to bring about that end of suffering, the fourth noble truth. So today we're talking about the cause of suffering or arising of suffering. Dukkhang Samudayam is the Pali for that. And as we talked about last time, the dimension of suffering that's being addressed in Buddhist practice is the mental suffering, the way we make things worse, subtly and obviously. There are other forms of hardship, including aging, sickness, and death, and the Buddha experienced all of those. But what was remarkable about him and many awakened people in the Buddhist tradition or in other traditions is that those events did not have to bring mental hardship. There wasn't anything extra added. And this is quite remarkable. I saw this as a chaplain too in the hospital. There's some days I would visit multiple dying people, and the range of difference in their experience of the same process, biological process, all of us will go through, could be remarkably different. One person could be despairing and fighting and angry. And I would go to the next person, and you couldn't walk in a room without being hit with just radiant love and peace. So the possibility of not suffering, no matter what arises, is the promise of this practice. It's the promise of this practice. And of course, a lot of other things arise that aren't so nice before that point in our lives, right? So one way of really helping to address this is to notice what causes suffering in the moment and over the long term. And in the earliest preserved teachings of the Buddha, he identifies the cause of suffering as craving, tanha. Thirst is one of the literal meanings of this word. So it's craving for something to be different, craving for wanting what I don't have or not wanting what I do have. We've all been there, right? It's human. Craving is what ties us to the cycles of suffering, samsara. The cycles of suffering and rebirth, whether it's rebirth over multiple lifetimes or rebirth into the dukkha, the suffering of a moment, a situation. So, how many times, just think about it for a minute, have you experienced suffering, dissatisfaction, dis-ease from an unmet craving? It could be as simple as wanting to be somewhere in heavy traffic, or as profound as, oh, do I have a purpose? What's the outcome going to be of this action? What's my role, my image? Tenzin mentioning capitalism, I already had this in my notes. Marketers have figured this out, right? They capitalize on craving. They market to craving. And that satisfaction of getting what we want is ephemeral, the hedonic treadmill, it's called. And it's so ephemeral that it can then be hijacked to help us want more, buy more, get more, do more, whatever that more is. There was a study I heard about that the maximum, highest moment of satisfaction in making a purchase is the moment a person hands the credit card over. That's the high point, right? It's just bizarre. So then the cycle continues. Another simile that I really love for the empty promise of craving. Who here has seen a kitten playing with a laser pointer or a cat? Okay. It is quite a remarkable sight. In my young adulthood, my boyfriend and I had a kitten. We had a couple of friends over, and our friend introduced us to the magic of the laser pointer. It's this little red dot that moves around, right? That kitten was going nuts, just like trying to grab it, catch it, eat it, paw it. And what happens if you try to grab a piece of light, a little red dot? It can't be caught. You can't get it. My friend Eddie just sort of shook his head looking at this, and he goes, "We all have our little red dots. And don't we? What's your little red dot today? Can you see it?" That's the cause of the suffering, is the relationship to it, the craving for it, not the dot itself, whether it's a person, a job, an ice cream cone, whatever. So that craving leads to grasping and clinging, which then just compounds difficulty. A famous teacher in this tradition, Ajahn Chah, calls suffering rope burn, clinging to something that's moving out of our grasp anyway, right? So, the task in the ancient teachings, there's a task associated with something to be done for each of the noble truths. And suffering is to be understood, the first noble truth. The cause of suffering, craving, is to be abandoned. Let go. Let go of the cause in this moment. This is a quote from the Dhammapada. If its root remains undamaged and strong, a tree, even if cut, will grow back. So, too, if latent craving is not rooted out, suffering returns again and again. If the latent cause of craving is not rooted out, the latency, the suffering returns again and again. To root out craving is synonymous with full awakening. And we can do a lot in our daily lives and our moments of practice to root out causes in between now and then. One of the keys is that it's helpful to understand the causes of suffering. Craving is underpinned by many other conditions or dependencies in a process known as dependent arising or dependent co-arising. And the foundational condition underpinning craving is ignorance, avidya. It's ignorance of a constantly changing, dependently constructed or arisen nature of human experience, a sense of a centralized self that doesn't change, that's under our control completely, that doesn't age, sicken, die. So the Buddha's proposition is, well, if we can't control the constantly changing nature of life and human experience, can't really call it self or under the bailiwick of something that's fixed and unchanging. It's all dependently constructed. Another term for this is empty, because it's an aggregate, a coalescence of everything that's happening in our life, everything that's happening in our mind. One of the propositions of the Buddha's teachings is that so much suffering falls away when we don't try to control the uncontrollable, when we no longer put ourself at the center of things, when ourself is no longer the sole primary reference. Because the craving comes from a sense of me needing this, me needing that to shore up my identity, me, myself, and mine. If instead there's a, oh, it can be, and I can just be in relationship to it, So much falls away. There's an ease and a lightness. So that ignorance of the way things are, underpins the craving, right? And the craving can manifest in all these different forms, and the three primary ones are greed, hatred, and delusion, kleshas, or mental afflictions. And greed, hatred, and delusion, or the absence of them, lay the groundwork for the next moment, the next choice, the way that our lives eventually go on a trajectory. Happily, the opposites of greed, hatred, and delusion, though some of you came to my class on this, also underpin the way our lives can move and flow, the direction they go. These beautiful factors like joy, generosity, happiness, wisdom, mindfulness also begin to influence the direction ourselves, our experience of the world, evolve. So, the Buddha says in another discourse, whatever a practitioner ponders upon, thinks about, obsesses on, mulls over, that becomes the inclination of their mind. And someone was talking earlier about how it's so easy to default. It's a natural human tendency to default to what's wrong, what's not going well. And it's also a natural capacity of our minds to shift and be able to nourish what's good, what's going right, happiness, kindness. Those two can become mindfulness, wisdom can become other latent tendencies in the mind. So these latent tendencies in the early tradition are also known as kind of biases, almost. And they're usually unhelpful until we start to shift things through practice, shift things towards what can cause joy, that generosity, that kindness, that mindfulness. And when these craving-based, the unhelpful latent tendencies, biases, meet the world circumstance, suffering results. Craving for approval or validation, craving for a person, a situation. But the promise of Buddhist practice is that new tendencies, new seeds of possibilities can take root in our minds and hearts. Love, kindness, generosity, gratitude, mindfulness, wisdom, peace. In either case, tendencies of our minds shape and shift our very perceptions themselves. They shape and shift. If I'm expecting someone to be mean because they remind me of a childhood bully, how am I going to show up with them? There's going to be a little guarding, maybe, right? A little suspicion, a little distance. And this is all implicit. It's not at a level of conscious awareness often. That shifts the dynamic of that relationship, or certainly of my heart and mind in relationship to them. On the other hand, if a person reminds me of my childhood best friend, I might show up with openness, kindness, a warmth that has nothing to do with them per se, but that can then start a chain reaction in the relationship. That's quite beautiful. These kinds of expectations can weave through to an entire class of people. Unconscious bias of racism, for example. If there is the cultural conditioning or even neurological conditioning to consider other a threat, that has a ripple effect through all of my relationships with that other, unless it's mindfully seen and worked with, there can be an unconscious threat response. And these days, we have names for these systemic forms of dukkha, of suffering, that were kind of only glimpsed, talked about in the most basic foundational way in the early teachings. The systemic level of racial or ethnic or caste divisions, of economic divisions, all of those, in a sense, are magnified ignorance, magnified calcified craving. So, what we can do about it is, again, knowledge. Knowledge is power, vijja, the opposite of avijja, ignorance. Turning backwards to our own experience and noticing whatever a latent tendency is, a bias is, and to stay with the example of race or other oppressed beings, I can start to become a friend to those at risk for harm. There's a conscious process of seeing that tendency and seeing it with mindfulness counteracts it. A person can meet this kind of process heroically, such as when German citizens sheltered Jews from peril and worse, the Holocaust, or white Southerners helping escaped slaves on the Underground Railroad. And it can also be small and humble ways of showing up with an unhoused person or a person in need, ways of showing up for myself that acknowledge my own tendencies or irritations or blind spots and open my heart to anyone I'm with, including myself. In any of these cases, working with craving, perhaps of needing to look a certain way or be a certain way or have a certain outcome, is what allows benefit to emerge. The arising of the cause of dukkha in a moment, in a lifetime, in a society, all of those are dependently arisen, conditioned by craving and myriad conditions, and underpinned by ignorance. So to turn it back inwards, the ancient teachings are really pragmatic. Notice craving. Notice when you reach for the little red dot. Right? Notice its effects, and just in that moment, that is the root of the arising of mental suffering, whether it's for a treat or a situation or an outcome. If craving arises, mental suffering follows. If craving ceases, mental suffering ends too. So that was a lot of words. Thank you for your kind attention. We are going to ask you now to take a moment, collect yourselves while we set it up. And we're going to ask you to go in small groups. I think what would we decide, like 3 people, something like that? No, we didn't decide. 3 or 4 people, depending on how the numbers work. And to ask yourself, share with your friends, what are some of the causes of suffering in your life? How does craving or ignorance influence your life? So we have about 20 minutes. So one significant way this cause of suffering might show up. And if you have time, more than one, but go around with one first. Yes, Heidi.
Maybe count off the bonds.
Sure. Yeah. Why don't you start?
1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah. No. Oh, yeah.
Okay. 1, 2, 3, Four. One. Two. Three. Four.
Two.
Oh.
One.
You're four, I think. So, so I'm sorry I cut the process short. I thought everybody had gone. So if the first one could hold up their hand and people gather around her, the first two, the first three, the first four, and self-organize yourselves. So welcome, oops. Welcome back, everybody. Welcome back, Zoom room. I was waiting for the bell to finish, but I would have been waiting a while longer.
Very resonant, this
Very,
massive bell.
very resonant, Pella. So want to invite you to share how that was for you and what came up from your own life. And also, if you do have any questions about the talk, you can feel free to ask them. So, yes, Heidi, if you wait for the mic.
Well, we had a big gnarly question. What about suffering, which was very loved in our group, when it's really based on compassion for suffering in the world, where we're not able to accept things as they are, and wondered about the role of Buddhists and activism to change the world as it is. What we do with our own suffering just because it breaks our heart seeing what's going on in them.
So I'll give you a couple of the classic Buddhist answers, and then there's more human ways of approaching this. So the first thing to keep in mind is there's a distinction between two words, and I'm going to use the Pali because I don't know the Sanskrit for the second one, but karuna, compassion, and there is anukampa, which is that quivering of the heart, movement of the heart when it sees suffering, when mindfulness or love comes in contact with suffering. And classically, compassion, even though it's in the English, comes from the Latin, that is to suffer with or to be with, it means something a little bit different in the ancient Buddhist teachings. It is the movement of wishing to help, but it doesn't necessarily involve mental suffering of the person who wants to help. So, compassion itself is an uplifting emotion. And the suffering that our hearts cling on to is what we're taking on in addition to that wish to help, that empathy, that empathic response, which is a little bit closer maybe to the anukampa, the wanting to care. And we're human. Our hearts break. Hopefully, they break open and don't shut down. So, a fully awakened being doesn't suffer at the suffering of the world. They just move to respond. And then there's the rest of us. Okay. I mean, my heart breaks at some of the things happening in the world right now. So the question in my mind becomes, how do we begin to relate to the difficulty, the empathic response, the wish to help, in a way that allows us to respond without suffering more for being open to it? Is there a way to let go of clinging or craving for things to be different, while still moving out of a place of compassion? It's a tall order. I'm not pretending that it's easy or that it's even accessible to most of us. And that is kind of part of the Buddhist proposition, is kind of like going into a hospital and dying and not feeling despair, right? And there's a shift that happens deep within that still can be profoundly motivating. So on a practical level, when suffering arises for the world, to turn towards it with love in your own heart, turn towards your own suffering and that empathic suffering with love, compassion, patience, kindness. That's one way to begin to approach it. Tintin, would you like to add anything?
Yeah. It's just, you know, thinking of exactly what Dawn said, and there's sort of a correlate in some of the research that's being done. I'm thinking of Tanya Singer's research at Max Planck Institute, and she researches empathy and compassion a lot. And so she has this model that I really like. So she says, empathy can lead to two different pathways. It can either lead to empathic distress, which is what some people call compassion burnout, but she says with real compassion, we don't burn out. It's really empathic distress that we're overwhelmed by the suffering that we witness, you know, which leads to overwhelm, you know, withdrawal, self-focused emotions, or it can lead to, our empathy can lead to compassion, which is, you know, as Dawn said, that wish to engage and wish to do something about it, which, you know, some of those researchers say you can't burn out if it's real compassion because you're rising to the occasion. And it's interesting what's happening neurologically, completely different parts of the brain being activated by those two states. And there's activation in the brain with compassion, even though you're not doing anything yet, there's activation in the brain that associates with actual physical activity that's protective against burnout. And what relates for me to Buddhism is the idea that nothing is static, permanent, and fixed. Every situation can be changed. So with that promise, it may not be easy, it may not be short term, but for me, that motivates me to take some action or do something to meet the suffering, knowing that nothing is inherently existent, as we would say sometimes in Buddhism, or solid or fixed. So things can move. And then if we meet it with compassion, so compassion in the text is described as kind of this bittersweet emotion, like it feels pleasant, but it requires an awareness of suffering, but mixed with the wisdom that says something can change if we engage. When we feel like it's just concrete fix, there's nothing we can do, then we go into empathic distress. And then that's when people are like, there's nothing I can do. I can't even watch the news anymore. I'm done. I can't, you know. So it's, to me, all of the wisdom about Buddhism in terms of cause and effect, which we're going to be talking about next, really informs that compassionate response. Yeah. Does that help the dilemma? Yeah, it's a really tough one. Yeah.
It's an important question. Thank you for the question. So we have time for one or two short ones, one not so short one, or one short, couple of short ones. Anyone else? things that don't make us go quite so into our philosophy and any response, other responses to how the groups were? Yes. And if you could say your name once you had the mic. Sorry, I didn't think to ask that before.
I'm Denise. And the group was really wonderful. It caused me to deepen my own reflective process, because I could see myself in each person. So the group process was very enriching. Yeah.
Thank you, Denise. Anyone on Zoom want to chime in? Friends in your little boxes in your homes.
Yeah, Sheila, I see your hand up. And let's see, let me prompt you to unmute. There you go.
Thank you. We spoke of suffering both physical and mental. Physical, you know, something like a fractured wrist, and mental, particularly loss in a relationship, either of life or of connection, and how we feel about that. And is there something that we can do to deal with it? And some what we were talking about mostly was connection with other people, and being particularly groups like this, and laughter, some kind of fun if possible. Also, just looking at reality and trying to have kind of a soft acceptance of the way it is, and what we can control and what we can't control. So we had a very lovely discussion. We enjoyed it. Thank you.
Wonderful.
Sounds like you covered a lot of bases
We
in
did.
20 minutes, the whole path. Awesome. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Shayla. So, any other burning questions or comments before we go on break? Yes, in the back. And for the benefit of those on Zoom, if you could say your name, that would be great.
I'm Katie, and the group discussion, it was evident that we all suffer from the same thing. But nothing here is, we were kind of laughing at some point because how human it is that we all struggle with the same things, and that's what connects us at the end of the day.
Thank you. And I just want to lift that up. That is what connects us at the end of the day. So this is one of those shifts for many people that connection and compassion can provide, is removing the illusion that my suffering is mine alone, and that I'm in a cave and I'm all by myself and it's all my fault or it's all my responsibility. Oh, this is human. And we're all kind of, maybe not in the same boat, but we're definitely in the same ocean. So thank you very much, everyone, for your questions, for your wisdom, for your hearts, for compassion. We are going to go on break. And what time should we have them come back, do you think?
10 minutes?
Yeah.
Is 10 minutes enough?
10 minutes
on. And I heard there's Girl Scout cookies in the kitchen.
Thin minutes. Thin mints and tea in the kitchen for anyone who wants it.
3.5 hours.
If it's thin mints, we need more time. Okay.
So enjoy.
So come back at 5. Let's see. According to that clock, it'll be exactly 11. According to that one.
Great.
Yeah. Oh, when they give it back to me.
So what we're going to do now is we've been investigating in our discussion groups, and now we're going to investigate with a little bit of a contemplation, a little guided practice. So we've been talking about the causes of suffering. Dawn has been mentioning craving, which is seen as the root of suffering. There's a whole variety of what are called kleshas in the Buddhist scripture, which is seen as one of the causes of suffering. One kind of easy definition of what these things are: any thought that's disturbing of your peace of mind. And so sometimes klesha is translated as disturbing emotion. Not all of them are emotions, but they're like thoughts or mental events that are disturbing to your peace of mind. They include things like emotions like anger, jealousy, envy, things like that. And one way of looking at them is investigating for ourselves, how much is our peace of mind disturbed by these things that are exaggerations, maybe, of reality? Right? Attachment, sometimes defined as experiencing something as pleasant, exaggerating the pleasant qualities of the object, and then thinking that by obtaining, possessing, and retaining it, I'm going to have lasting happiness. So it's a setup, right? The exaggeration of the qualities being in the object. So we'll explore that a little bit. I'll guide you through. I'll give you some prompts and then pause and just kind of think about how some of these ideas relate to your own experiences of, you know, suffering in the realm of mental peace of mind being disturbed, right? Just that unease mentally from those kleshas or mental afflictions. One translator calls them mental afflictors, which is even maybe more accurate, which disturb our peace of mind, the mental afflictors. So I'll invite you to just get into a comfortable yet alert posture with your back straight, your shoulders even. We're just going to be sitting for about 10 minutes or so. So just in a comfortable position for a few minutes of reflection. You can have your eyes either in a hooded gaze, slightly open or closed, whatever's comfortable for you, and just taking a moment to settle in and check your body. See if there's any tightness or tension or constriction that's kind of crept in, and deliberately relax. And then taking a moment just to settle with the breath, to just really get yourself here in your body, in the present moment. And so now I'd like to invite you to think of an experience of attachment, and attachment in this context meaning that craving that Dawn was talking about, that thought that if I somehow obtain that thing, it could be a material object, it could be a relationship with a person, could even be some sort of event or experience. If I have that experience, if I connect with that person, if I obtain that possession, I'll have happiness. That thing is the source of my happiness. So we all have this. Think of a time, maybe recently, where you had that experience. And as you recall that experience, how peaceful was your state of mind when you were engaged in that experience? Maybe before, during, and after, if you actually were able to have that experience or buy that possession or enjoy the piece of chocolate cake, check your state of mind. What does it feel like to have that craving arise? To actually have the thing or the experience? And then how does it feel after or when you have the possession? Just check from your own experience. And then check, was there any quality of exaggeration about that experience of craving or attachment? As Dawn mentioned in her chaplaincy example, it's not so much what happens to us that causes the pleasant or unpleasant experience, that's in our minds. But how much in that moment of craving or attachment did you think, oh, happiness really lies in that object, in that experience? Happiness is inherent in that object. And how much did you exaggerate how happy that would make you feel? That moment of pleasure we have when we're handing over the credit card, that anticipatory happiness. And how does it feel after we actually already have the possession or the experience? What's our level of happiness there? And then let's just take a moment to do the same thing with an experience of aversion. So similar definition, but the opposite. Experiencing something as unpleasant, exaggerating the unpleasant qualities of the object, and trying to minimize our contact or avoid contact or experience. So think of something maybe recently you were dreading, maybe not looking forward to, maybe imagining that you were going to experience as unpleasant. It could have been some sort of a meeting or maybe even a medical procedure or doctor's appointment, or maybe a presentation you had to give at work, or whatever it may be. And check, what was your state of mind going into that experience? And then how did it feel during and after? Was there any exaggeration present? Was that thing as bad as you were expecting? And do other people have a different experience with that object, with that meeting, with that event? If the unpleasantness were inherent in that object, everyone would have the same experience. How much does your mind play a factor in whether something is pleasant or unpleasant? And so I often recommend to students what I call a one-size-fits-all solution to so many of these mental afflictors, these different states of mind that are unpeaceful. And sometimes it can be very helpful to just ask yourself, what am I exaggerating? And your peace of mind is disturbed. What am I exaggerating? Okay. So continuing our exploration of the causes of suffering, and so Dawn's been giving us the overview of the second noble truth, this idea of this craving being at the root of what gives rise to suffering, and then the craving and the other mental afflictors give rise to karma, which is another cause. It sort of arises. Don and I were talking about sort of this, the ignorance about the way things exist, about the way we exist sort of underlies everything. It gives rise to this, the mental afflictors that I was just talking about, that's that kind of root ignorance that underlies everything. And then these disturbing thoughts based on a misperception of the way things exist, a misperception of reality and exaggeration. And then those often can give rise to actions motivated by, right, those mental afflictions, those kleshas. So we all know attachment can give rise to certain actions. We try to get the thing that we want, sometimes skillful, often can be also unskillful actions motivated by that craving. Also the aversion obviously gives rise often to unskillful behaviors. This last week I do some trainings on de-escalation, and I did a bunch of trainings with poll workers to prepare for the new election coming up. Boy, oh boy, does aversion give rise to unskillful actions? They had all these examples. We were workshopping together. So we all know from our own experience how, you know, the exaggeration of the unpleasantness existing in the object, and then you do all kinds of things to get rid of the, you know, separate yourself from the object. And the same is true for those other jealousy, envy, all of the other mental afflictors. So karma, a very misunderstood concept, I've got like 12 minutes to explode the myths about karma. I was talking to Dawn and saying, I usually do like 10-day retreats on karma, you know, so how to give the essence. And I think the most useful thing is just to talk a little bit about what karma is and what it is not, and the promise of karma. Because sometimes karma is used in kind of our popular culture is almost a dirty word. Oh, something bad happened. Oh, that's their karma. You know, it's used kind of casually and informally, and even appears in some dictionary definitions because it's now a word in English. It is migrated into the English language in the Oxford English Dictionary, which is proof that it's now English. And some of the definitions are something like fate or destiny, right? And you'll hear people say stuff like I said, like, that's their karma, as if that bad thing that happened to that person is somehow their fate or their destiny. And so that gives us an idea, which is also found in some ancient Indian philosophical schools, that there is this destiny that's kind of predetermined, like your life is predetermined, you know, by your karma. It's not very changeable, not very mutable. And this is one of the differences that the Buddha had between some of these ancient philosophical schools. For example, Don was mentioning the caste system, and in India, still very much in existence. You know, all kinds of things determined by that. So if you were a Havali, your family were sweets makers, you didn't have any wiggle room. You learned how to make sweets, and then that's what you did, because that was seen as your karma, like your destiny or your fate. Not a Buddhist idea at all. Not a Buddhist idea at all. The word karma literally means action. So it refers more to the beginning stages. It's not the result. It's that movement, first the movement of the mind, that then motivates maybe a verbal or physical action. So it refers to the cause, and it's changeable, it's mutable. It's not like your destiny is, you know, predestination. I mean, in some Protestant sects, big arguments, is there predestination, meaning everything's fixed? Do you have free will? All of this. So there's similar kind of debates in Buddhism, but in Buddhism, the Buddha said we're always experiencing the results of previous karmic seeds. We use the word seed. Sometimes the Tibetan word is bhakchak. There's all these agricultural metaphors in Buddhism that aren't exact at all, but it's just a way of thinking of it. We've got these karmic seeds ripening into our experiences, and then we're always creating more. So one of my friends who's a Buddhist teacher, it's beautiful, he says, the way we change our lives is gardening, not manipulating in the moment. Like something's happening to you that's unpleasant. We're like, no, it's going to rain. And he says, garden, just garden. You know, plant those virtuous karmic seeds and just wait, water them. But you have to be patient. Any gardener, you can't yank up the tulips out of the ground because you want them to be there right away. So there's this idea that we're always planting. We're always planting the new causes for the later experiences that we're going to be having. And that's the way that karma works. So there's this beautiful promise to karma of like, we have agency over our experience. There isn't this thing that somehow we inherited or our family or whatever, our past life. Yes, we're bringing stuff forward, but we're always having this opportunity. And that's the promise of practice. And so I mentioned before this text, the Abhidharmakosha, this collection of, there are three baskets of Buddhist teachings. There's the sutras or the discourses. There's the Vinaya, the vowed morality teachings. And then there's the Abhidharma, the text on manifest knowledge. And so this master Vasubandhu in 350 AD collected, you know, these texts of Abhidharma, which is Buddhist cosmology, Buddhist psychology, all these things about like how things work, all the collection of the teachings that the Buddha gave about how things work. And the fourth chapter of that text is all about karma. And so the first verse of that chapter says, all the worlds of this universe come from karma. That karma consists of thinking and anything that thinking makes you do. So there's this, like, the rawest form of karma is this intention, this motivation, this movement of the mind. So there's mental karma, and then there's physical and verbal karma. So again, all the worlds of this universe come from karma. That karma consists of thinking and anything that thinking makes you do. And so by the Buddha's teachings, the Buddha was refuting two major views about why things happen. And both of those views are shared by us, even though they're different philosophical bases. One is there's an omnipotent supreme being who makes things happen. Anybody heard that idea? Right? So in ancient India, there was that idea too. Things happen because there's this all-powerful god or gods or beings that make things happen. So again, we don't have much agency. And in some religious traditions, I think the idea is, oh, please the gods. So a lot of the religious practices is like, if you supplicate, if you pray, if you please, if you make offerings in ancient India, offerings, then they'll be happy with you and bad things won't happen. And the Buddha's like, nope, actually, it's not like that either, right? So there isn't this idea of pleasing a supreme being. And then there was a philosophical school also common at the time of the Buddha called the Vaisheshikas. And they have this idea that everything's just random. There is no such thing as cause and effect. It's all just random. And the best that we can hope for is to cope somehow with random events kind of coming at us, right? There's no order in things at all. And the Buddha's like, no, it's actually not like that either, because all the worlds of the universe come from karma. And so the details of karma, incredibly complex, also very difficult. They say that only beings at a very, very high level of realization can directly see exactly which causes lead to which results. It's called a deeply hidden phenomenon, the actual mechanism of karma, which one. But we can know by relationship in general. And the Buddha taught a lot about what actions to do, how to garden. You know, all the Buddha's morality wasn't about pleasing the supreme being. The Buddha was like, yo, you want to have good things happen? Garden well, plant the right kind of seeds. You know, so all of the vowed morality in Buddhism was really gardening instructions about how to plant the seeds for the kind of results that we want. One thing that I found in teaching karma, which I don't usually try and do in 15 minutes, but you guys are special, so we'll do that. One thing that people often, you know, from so-called like Western culture, they have the idea that karma means you're being punished. Like if you have an unpleasant experience, somebody's punishing you. Right? For that you did some bad thing, so you deserve to suffer, you deserve to be punished. It's not like that at all. It's as impersonal as laws of physics. It's just saying, what is it? Newton's third law of motion. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. That's all. Right? So it's not like you're being punished. It's not like you deserve reward. There's no them out there keeping track. It's imprints in your own mind. You know, your own mind is keeping track, right? And has these imprints that later, when they meet with the right conditions, ripen into some sort of a result. So when is that going to happen? There's a really pesky lag period between cause and result. If karma were instant, we behave really differently than we do, right? There's this very pesky lag period. So we can't really see that what we've done. They're like, I just gave a big donation to my favorite nonprofit and then walked downstairs and twisted my ankle. What's up with that? Well, those two things have no relationship with each other at all. You making a big donation means you're going to experience abundance at some point in the future. You twisting your ankle, whatever, right? So John Lennon was wrong. Instant karma is not a thing, right? But this idea of where things actually come from, you know, like I said, that's the promise of Buddhism, because we don't, you know, our Buddhist practice isn't just sort of deflecting or somehow coping with random events, and there's no supreme being that we supplicate. We just have to be mindful of our actions of body, speech, and mind, and try to cultivate, you know, as virtuous ones as possible to then plant the seeds for the kind of results that we want. So we're going to do another discussion group, but I wanted to pass the baton to Don if you've got some things you'd like to say about karma. I mean, as I said, how much time do we have? But yeah.
You may be watching us plan our next retreat in action right here. I think you covered it beautifully, Tenzin, given the short period of time. Just to note, I don't know the Sanskrit for this, but the Pali karma or kamma in Pali technically means action. So as Tenzin was saying, it's what we do. It's all the subtle and not so subtle enactments of mind, of speech, and of body. And there's another word for results, vipaka. Do you know the Sanskrit for the fruit? Phala. Phala is another word. So this cause and effect, this capacity to influence, is just something to keep in mind as you consider in that pesky wag time and the complexity that multiple actions, past actions, and multiple results are always intersecting all of the time. The Buddha said at one point that if a regular person tried to contemplate all of the details of karma, their head would explode. So the invitation is not to explode your head in this next conversation.
Thank you. Yeah, and that's so important too, like any given thing. And this kind of relates to Heidi's question from your last discussion group, knowing that our actions make a difference, but it's so complex. So what we try and do to change a situation is one of just such a myriad of causes and conditions coming together to form a result, right? It's so complex. So the invitation, and maybe do we keep in the same group or switch? What do you think?
It might be nice to switch, and I realize not everyone was in a group. I'm not sure if you wanted to be or not. Okay, so
maybe we'll switch it up. We'll figure out how to count off differently, or maybe we'll do it geographically and
yeah,
split the room down the middle, and then two groups on each side of the room, split where the pole is. And the invitation for this discussion are: what are some of the ideas that you've had about why things happen, both in your life, maybe things you were taught as you were growing up, or just your own, just trying to figure out stuff? What are some of the ideas you've had about why things happen? And does this idea of cause and effect make sense to you? Or do you still really like the idea of randomness or God or something else? Just what are some of the ideas there are about why things happen the way they do? So we'll have, I think, 15 minutes for this one, a little bit shorter than the last time for this extremely profound question. So go ahead and organize yourself into roughly four little geographic clusters, and we'll ring the bell in 15 minutes. Enjoy. So as we did last time, We'd love to just open up for any either reflections from your small groups and or clarifying questions that might have come up for you, or total confusion that you need us to manage, or all of the above. Yes, Mitchell.
And you need to turn it on.
Oh, I was struck by how in our group it felt like we were all little universes, you know, each of us having a universal experience that was personal to us, and everybody was very, very radically different almost.
Yeah.
In our reactions, in our confusion, not had a whole such a big question and stuff like that. Just discovering those differences was very revealing to me and as a leader.
Yeah, really. You know what your reflection makes me think of, Mitchell, is I often think of like concentric circles of shared karmic experience. You know, like everybody in this room is having roughly a shared experience of being in this room. But of course, within that, like you say, all of us are having completely unique, like this room is full of just all these universes of completely unique, some shared concentric circle, but you know, ultimately, yeah. So thank you. Any other comments, either from the Zoom room or the physical room?
I have a microphone. How about if I talk?
Good idea, Catherine.
There's this thing that keeps coming up. I learned, I think, from Pema Chodron, which was is that in meditation you burn up the seeds of karma.
Huh.
That's all. That struck me as really great, and in part because I had used to have this inner physical sensation of burning, and so anyway, that pointed always to the benefit of meditation. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how come she might have said that, and with how you.
Well, you know, it's interesting. It reminds me of a funny story. I remember years and years ago, these two friends of mine, we were all living in Dharamsala, where His Holiness the Dalai Lama lives, and studying at a Tibetan Buddhist center there. And this friend, this nun from New Zealand, is walking up. There's a very steep hill. The meditation center is like a very, very steep hill. She was walking up. It was during monsoon. It's raining like mad. And this British monk is walking down the hill. And as he's walking down, he slips and falls. And he gets up and snaps his fingers and says, "Great, another one down." And so we're always burning through every time we have an experience. Right, like that, we're burning through another karmic seed. And then what Pema Chodron may have also meant was, remember I said there's this underlying ignorance that actually is one of the conditions that makes that karmic seed ripen into an experience for us. So the more through our meditation practice, we develop the wisdom that counteracts that underlying ignorance, then it's the metaphor again, agricultural metaphors is given. It's like scorching the seed so it won't ever sprout and give a result, right? So like the more meditation that we do, we're actually scorching, you know, and the seed is still there, but it will never ripen into a result because that underlying condition has been eliminated. So I would imagine something like that might have been what she meant. Yeah. Yeah, but every time something crappy happens, great, another one down. And there are other ways to deal with karma rather than just experiencing all the crappy stuff. But if you happen to slip and fall, it's a nice attitude to have instead of perpetuating by having another negative reaction to the bad thing that happened. You know, see it as purification. Yeah.
Yeah, great.
Sheila. Sheila, you're still muted.
I was saying that we had an interesting discussion about this difficult topic, and we found it very difficult. Why do things happen? And we really don't know. And we went all the way from no free will to luck to having the right attitude to moving our mind to something to actually having a physical action or change in life. And feeling that we did have some agency of various amounts. So we didn't know, but yeah. We worked and tried to work it out. It's a big, big question.
Yeah, it's such a huge question, and how many different explanations there are for why things happen. And that's one of the kind of the purposes of religion. You know, not only to explain what happens after we die, but to explain why things happen. That's why, like, religions and so many different ideas and the different philosophical ideas on top of that. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I love exploring that, because how many times have you ever sat around with people and, why do things happen? Right? Maybe never before today. So awesome. Thank you. Great. Let's see, over to you.
Okay. So the invitation is to settle into a few minutes of meditation. And whatever posture feels most hospitable to balancing alertness and relaxation, metabolizing some of the energy from this recent conversation. So settling in whatever way makes most sense for you today, maybe a couple of extra longer, slower, deeper breaths. And allowing the exhale to invite letting go, relaxation into the moment. Noticing the ambient sounds in the room. Noticing your breath, body, and feeling into whatever is evoked in your heart and your mind so far today. Noticing whatever arises with awareness, mindfulness. Bringing interest to the experience of this moment. Noticing where your attention is pulled and where it makes sense, when it makes sense to direct, choose to bring the attention back to this moment, this breath, this sound, this silence. Allowing the experience of this body to anchor you to the moment. Always returning. Going to say a few brief words here to build on what Tenzin was talking about in the last little Dharma talk, we'll wrap, about where we have agency, where the mind and heart have agency. It's not an exaggeration to say that the entire Buddhist path of practice rests upon the proposition that we have at least just a little bit of play, of choice, to shift our minds, the conditions in our lives, the way we perceive things. And these shifts can be gradual, hardly seeable at all, and they're not the only forces happening in our lives, right? There's the myriad causes and conditions, the complexity of the interaction that Tenzin was speaking to and that I mentioned, is also in play. And one of my friends, a Buddhist teacher, has a simile that I just love for this. Imagine that you're watching a kayaker and she's in this huge river, rapids and white water, and you know, it's gorgeous and quite wild. She puts her boat in and she begins to kayak down the river. She didn't choose the weather conditions that day. She didn't choose the quality of the water or the rapids or the course, the trajectory of the river itself. What she does choose is, and what she can condition is, how skillfully she can navigate the rapids, avoid the rocks, flow through with what is. And that to me is just a beautiful way of articulating there's this flow of all of these different conditions in our lives. And there's that thread of choice. How are you paddling? How skillfully are you relating to the river? These little choices, large and small, they add up over time. The choice to practice is a huge one. And Tenzin was talking about her friend who uses the metaphor of becoming a good gardener, which is a metaphor I've used as well. And in part, it's no accident, this metaphor. The word bhavana, which means meditation in English, literally translates as cultivation. Are we cultivating our minds and hearts and lives? The beneficial seeds in a beneficial direction and letting practice, the sunlight of awareness, burn up the ones that aren't so helpful. And this also comes into play when really difficult things happen. Literally, in a garden, you compost the crap into humus, into nutritional soil for the plants. We can also compost the crappy things that happen by adjusting how we relate to them. Everything can be a learning opportunity, pretty much. There's a way of relating to the circumstances that might not fix them or change them objectively in any way at all, yet they can become nutriment, it's called in the ancient teachings, nutriment, compost for greater wisdom, awareness, freedom, generosity, happiness. That is the possibility of recognizing the causes of suffering and recognizing what we can have some will, choice about, and what is just blowing by in the river, the massive conditions around us. So it becomes then this collaboration with what is that allows us, each mind, each moment, to conversely shift just a little bit more. What's possible? What's possible? And one of the possibilities that the path of practice really opens up is this possibility of abandoning the cause of suffering. Abandoning craving in the moment can mean seeing it rather than acting on it. Seeing it move through as a blip rather than getting on that train and ending up seven stations down in a land that you don't recognize and definitely didn't want to be in. Right? You can just let the train go. Let the blip go. And that takes practice. That takes awareness and mindfulness. And the beautiful thing about expanding that capacity for choice, that capacity for freedom, is that the more we exercise that muscle, the stronger it gets. The more space there is, the more we're cultivating the beautiful things in the garden and allowing what's unhelpful to wither. So before we go into breakout rooms, Tenzin, do you have anything you'd like to add to that?
Yeah.
Huh?
No.
No? Okay.
That was beautiful.
Okay. It was the no yeah part that confused me.
Sorry. It's sort of a New Zealand thing. I think that's no yeah.
Excellent. If you can't tell, we enjoy each other. So we're going to send you back into breakout groups for a little while. And the question is going to be about this noticing where you have agency for yourself. Where do you have the capacity to shift how you're relating to a situation or a situation? So to keep it easy, can't think of a better way to break this room out than what we did last time. If you would self-organize again across the pole, and you're not going to be in completely different groups, so you may as well go with the same folks, unless someone else near you happens to be there who wasn't there before, in which case invite them in, be friendly. So groups of four or five, and exploring this question, you'll have about 15 minutes. So maybe go around first and explore it individually, and then you can all discuss. And if you're someone who really loves to talk, step back a little. If you're someone who's kind of shy, consider stepping forward a little.
So you want us to go back to the groups we were in?
Yes, unless there happens to be, unless you've reconfigured your seating or someone else new is around, just be friendly, invite people in. Okay. Thank you. Welcome back, everyone. I know we have a few people on a quick bio break, so we're going to let you settle for a minute or two here.
So we'd love to just all hear again, same kind of thing, either sharing a little bit from what you discussed in your group or any questions you have. This is sort of our last sort of 10 minutes or so, including any Q&A, any final questions or reflections that you have from the day or what happened in your group, any reflections.
We will still have a closing circle. So it's not the last, but this is the last like meaty exchange. So there's questions, inspirations, observations.
Yeah.
One. Yep. Yep. I mentioned, and then we also spoke about what the music brought to our meditation. My initial response was, don't they know there's people meditating here? Possibly not. It doesn't matter what it wouldn't matter anyway. But and then seeing how my attention could move and change, and by the time rang the bell, it had softened considerably.
I'm grateful for that.
Nice. Thank you. Yeah.
Catherine
Alex.
Yeah. I just have a comment about the music too, because I think the second discussion that she did, we talked about how like actions have karmic reactions that we aren't aware of. And I kind of had the same thought, and then I was like, you know, this is so telling, like he's influencing like, you know, 20, 30 people and he has no idea. He has no idea, or she has no idea, right? Whoever there has no idea. And I feel like that's true for like all of our karmic actions. Like we have no idea like what these little things are gonna be, like these little actions that's come off of that. So yeah.
I just have this thing of feeling like I'm invisible, and I'm so far from invisible. It's like, where does that idea, like, I'm just kind of going around and nobody's even like checking. And it's like, yeah, and really shifting that and going, no, actually, everything we do, you know, can be an inspiration to someone else or the opposite, or it definitely is having an impact. Yeah. Anybody in the Zoomiverse have a comment or a question? Arlene, you're still upright all these hours later. Congratulations. Awesome.
This has been very healing for me. Thank you so
good.
Much.
Good.
Yeah, really. Okay. It's been wonderful. And our group was just perfect. We had such a good discussion on every single thing. So I'm very grateful for that.
Awesome. Great.
Yeah.
Glad you're still with us.
Oh, thank you. Me too.
Yeah. Any other reflections or questions?
Oh, Susan, online.
A couple of things. I felt very aversive to coming today. And I always have an aversive reaction to breakout groups. And I don't, maybe 99.99 something, I'm thrilled that I did it. And it's so funny that I know that. And I tell myself that, don't believe myself. I just don't even believe it. Another, I'm really obsessed with the whole laser dot thing because I have two cats and they're my world. And I have a lot of issues with grasping myself. And so the thing that's such a mind you know what about it is they really did catch it. I mean, if you look, all thing, if it were a physical thing, they would have caught it because they got it right around their hand, but then it ends up magically appearing on the top side of their paw. And I think, isn't that just like the hungry ghost metaphor right there? So that's, and thank you all. This, thank you both. This has been a really wonderful day. So thank you.
Thank you, Susan. Yeah. I think the hungry ghost thing too, when you were saying that, I was thinking about like the moment of passing across the credit card, and then that's peak happiness. Like actually, you know, the hungry ghost can't even actually swallow and enjoy what they get, but that's us too. You know, we're off to the next thing by the time we've even got, I was saying to Don, you know, by the second bite of chocolate cake, you're off to the next thing. Like you were anticipating and you saw it in the case and you got it and they passed it and you're salivating. And by the second bite, she goes, it's a really good chocolate cake, maybe the fourth or fifth bite. But still, far before it's done, you're already off to the next thing in anticipation of the happiness.
All right, you want to take us away? Well, so our next activity is actually, I mentioned this last time to those of you who were here. This is a community practice that comes from my home temple at IMC and originally evolved in the Japanese Zen tradition, Soji, or temple cleaning. So the idea is 15 minutes. There are different tasks. This is all voluntary. You can just leave if you want to, but we are going to have a closing circle afterwards and some time together at the very end. But there are different small tasks you can knock out in 10 or 15 minutes. We'll meet back here at 5 till, 10 till, or a little bit early, so 10 till. So I'll read out ideas. If you want to, you can raise your hand. You can also just sit here and hang out while everyone else is cleaning. That will be boring, I promise. First thing is kitchen. Can I have two people to volunteer to help in the kitchen? Okay, we've got three. So Sue and Carol, I saw your names first. So I'm asking you to share the instruction sheet. You ladies can go ahead and go out, and then I'll keep reading off things. And we will ring a bell at the end so that you know. Next one is main entry, this foyer in here. You get two people for that, Heidi and Mitchell. So community room. Let's see. Do you think that's a one or a two person job? Two people for community room. Okay, you two, please.
Does that mean over there?
Yeah, that means their space. I checked with them. It's okay. Won't be doing that one. Someone volunteered to neatly arrange and restack the Zabuton Zafu's Jesse. Thank you. You do that one. Oh, and cleaning supplies, I should have said this earlier, are all in the closet off the kitchen. Jesse, would you mind letting them know that's where the cleaning supplies are before you get started? Thank you. And bathrooms, we've got, okay, thank you, Luita, and one other person. Thank you, Katie. Bathrooms, cleaning supplies are in the closet off the kitchen. And then the side entry, anybody feel like doing that?
I'll do it.
Okay.
Over by the bathroom.
Yes, the two of you, please. By the it's the hallway with the bathrooms. Oh. And then anyone else who wants to stay and clean the meditation hall, it probably only takes two people. And we've also got tidying up the library, which is off the community room. So if you're interested in library, okay. That's not the right one. Thank you, Deborah. And then meditation hall, This is the meditation hall. Well, so if you three could collaborate, or you two, and hopefully we have enough mops. If we don't, negotiate with the others. Do what you can. That can also include, if you want to, cleaning the glass.
And then for those of you on Zoom, you can just relax, and in about 10 minutes, we'll do a closing circle and the homework assignment for next week. So you can either clean your own house or just relax. Or lie down and have a nap.
And we'll be back here in 15 minutes.
We wish you could be with here with us cleaning, but you're off the hook for now.
Okay. See you soon.
Thank you.
Hi, everyone. So those of us in the room, the invitation is to stand and make a circle, with Tenzin and I being at one end because we're tethered to the computer. Otherwise, we would join you a little bit further in. And friends on Zoom, you are virtually part of this circle. You're very welcome. And if I could just pass the microphone around, and we'll do names and maybe a word of what you're taking away from today.
Okay.
And Catherine, can I ask you to step out of the camera's angle? Okay, great. Okay. Now we're getting a very good view of you and your mom.
A certain part of your anatomy that you may not want to be immortal on.
A very close up.
Okay. I'm Catherine. That was my
butt. And you're taking it with you when you
leave. Indeed.
My name's Dane. And what are we doing? I'm sorry.
Just one thing you're taking away with you today.
Joy. Mitchell, gratitude for Sandra. Danny, joy.
These and a new definition of karma as action. Alex and community. Ooh, and community. All my words. Renewal.
Rick, remembrance.
Make friends with desire.
What's your name?
Nika.
Rasa and questions.
Needy and curiosity.
Louisa and gratitude for all my teachers here today.
Carol and delight.
Joe and joy.
Heidi, connection.
Jesse, openness.
And friends on Zoom, maybe start with Eileen. I'm just going in order that we see.
Okay. Joy of sharing.
Sheila.
Sheila, opportunities.
Susan.
Love of my three online group members.
Nicole.
Shift the way I perceive things with mindfulness.
Beautiful. Thank you. So, you want to share anything?
delight also. Yeah.
Delight in Sangha and delight in the teachings. What a joy to be with all of you. Thank you very much for your practice, for your questions, for your sincerity, for your engagement. And those of you in person or those of you online, if you want to get in your cars, are welcome to join Tenzin and I for an informal lunch across the street at Abbott Square.
I've been in meditation.
And we'll be going there in about 5 minutes. It'll take us a few minutes to break things down, but all are welcome to join. Thank you so much. And may all beings everywhere benefit from our practice here together. You're free.